Thank you very much, Hans, and good morning, everyone. It's our pleasure as a PFS team to be back. You were a bit overwhelmed with number of people on the screen last time, so we reduced the number, but the rest of the team are watching intensely through the webcast, so we are still all here. So what we were going to cover today were two things. One is to continue and complete the discussion of the feedback on the exposure draft that we have done very well in December to discuss most of the topics, but we still have papers that are papers for this month, 21B to 21E, which we haven't covered. So I would suggest we start by covering those. So this is proposals relating to statement of cash flows and then feedback on other topics. And then Fred is going to summarize feedback from investors. And Anna is going to summarize the work she has done on reviewing literature relevant to the topics in the exposure draft. And then after that, we are going to discuss a proposed plan for redeliberating project proposals. So with that, it's my pleasure to hand over to Akhila. And this is her first board meeting where she's presenting, and she has joined the team as assistant technical staff in October. So she's done amazingly well to prepare paper so quickly and be ready to present for the, to the board. So you are very kind generally, but I'm asking you today to be even kinder than usual in questioning Akhila on the work she's done on the statement of cash flows. So over to you, Akhila.
Thank you, Aida, and good morning, everyone. Agenda paper 21B summarizes the feedback on the proposals relating to statement of cash flows. This agenda paper is identical to agenda paper 21I for the December 2020 board meeting. Many respondents did not comment on the proposals. Of those that did comment, many agreed with requiring operating profit or loss as the starting point for the indirect method of reporting cash flows from operating activities, and with the proposed classification of interest and dividend cash flows. Some said that the proposals would result in a consistent presentation that would enhance comparability between entities. However, there are some of the respondents that disagreed with the proposals. The main concern of those that did not agree was the lack of alignment between the statement of cash flows and the statement of profit or loss, which was also raised a concern by some fieldwork participants. The full feedback on alignment has been discussed in December 2020 agenda paper 21B feedback summary, subtotals and categories general model. In relation to starting point, a few said that they thought net profit was a more intuitive and understandable starting point for the indirect method of presentation of operating cash flows, and that it would be costly to make the change and that cost would exceed the benefits. Therefore, a few respondents suggested retaining the options over the starting point of indirect method. In relation to removing classification options for interest and dividends cash flows, some said that removing the options would require system changes, thus burden the entities. A few respondents suggested an approach that would converge with US GAAP, which stipulates interest and dividend cash flows to be classified as operating. Overall, some respondents requested a comprehensive review of IAS 7 Statement of Cash Flows. Questions for the board are in page 8. Is there any feedback or fieldwork evidence that is unclear? Are there any points or fieldwork evidence that are new information or staff need further research for the deliberations? I will turn it over to the board.
Thank you, Akhila. Well done. So, who can I give the floor to? Anne.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks, Akhila. On reading this paper, I thought that in this area, we need to do minimal changes because we actually know there's other things people would like changed about cash flow statement. And some of us at least are expecting it to come up in a gender consultation. So I'm concerned about making changes for primary financial statements and that they then clash or conflict with things that are coming up in a gender consultation. So in terms of your questions that you posed to us, I know you don't want us to tell you what to do, but my comment is about that I think we need to consider the interaction of however which way we decide to proceed with the cash flow statement here, and how that would interact with a larger project on cash flow. So without looking at exactly what we should do, I think we still have to look at that interaction. Thank you.
Nick?
Thanks, Hans. Yes, I was going to say, make a similar comment to the one that Anne just made. I mean, I was surprised by the strength of feeling towards alignment between the cash flow statement and the P&L, but that comes through as a very strong theme. And in some respects, we are offering through our proposals to eliminate the options a partial alignment. It's, you could describe it as a journey, perhaps towards full alignment. My nervousness is that we've looked at full alignment before in the previous financial statements project, and eventually we weren't able to deliver on full alignment. And I think that's the question. So it's that interrelationship between our proposals here and what we may do in a more comprehensive project that is, I guess, the one thing that is niggling away at the back of my mind. Thank you.
Bruce.
Thanks, Hans. My comments are almost similar, just to say that one of the major areas where I've always got feedback on this ED was the naming. You know, the one thing I think that's been done very well by the board over many years is trying to make sure that where we use terms, we're consistent, and to make sure that where people don't get that confusion. And I almost think that we've got to hear from the constituents who are clearly saying, guys, this is creating a challenge. When you're dividing things up, which are almost, I mean, when you're talking operating, investing, and financing, and you're talking identically the same terms, operating, investing, and financing, in two different statements with two different answers, I can see how that creates confusion. Now, that being said, I do appreciate that to bring a project on the cash flow into this project would just probably derail this one. And I think that would be a tragedy, because I think this is very important. So I think it would be very important to me to express and make sure to people we've heard that concern. I agree with what Nick says. I would be very surprised if this didn't come out of the agenda consultation, which could be great, because then we can say it's going to be addressed there. But I think it's almost like accepting we've heard that concern, we will look at it. I think if we acknowledge that we've heard that message and at some point, then people accept that this is not focused on that. But I think we can't just ignore it. Otherwise, I think, I can see a valid case for what they're saying.
Thank you, Bruce. Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with the comments made before, especially with Anne. This is a very rich feedback, but we need to segregate those that are important for the current project, the PFS, and those that are important for our future agenda, especially, for example, the review of the statement of cash flow. I think that in general, the feedback was positive in this area. I would just try to understand better the question on the alignment, despite we knew that it could arise and some definitely did it. But I would try to leverage on the field work feedback to see where exactly is the question on the alignment. And because we have included in our comments in the exposure draft and the base for conclusion, that they have different function. And that's probably the confusion, that despite we have using the same terms, they are not necessarily with the same objective. That's why I think that we are in the right way, but it would be worth looking at the, especially the field work feedback to try to understand whether there is any situation that we could seek for alignment. Thank you.
Okay, Mary.
Comments on a couple of things. One is some of the feedback has been a few suggested not eliminating options at this time, raising questions about whether it was worth doing one bid rather than the whole. In terms of your plan for redeliberation, without ignoring the comments from a few, I think we have to think about all the comments that we've received. I would not want to reopen, a fundamental debate about this just because there were a few. Just make sure, please, that it was, you know, that there's nothing new that we haven't thought about before in those. Because I think we always expected that when we take away options, some will be unhappy that they've lost some flexibility that they have. Same thing regarding the change in these, you know, for example, about the change in the starting point by specifying how the statement of cash flow should begin. And then I agree absolutely with not letting the desire to address alignment, which I understand why it troubles people, why they think there'll be confusion, but I agree with not letting that mushroom and take over this project and be a force that slows down the overall project. And so that's my overarching objective. In the context of that, there's one thing that occurred to me that I'd like to ask the staff to think about, whether it could be done, you know, within our contained scope, which is within the investing section of the statement of cash flows. Do you think that it would help if we required the within investing to be split to the piece of investing that relates to operations versus other pieces of investing? Because the fundamental conflict, as it were, is that when you, let's say, invest in property, plant, and equipment that will be used in operations, that investment in the statement of cash flows goes into investing, while the impairment while related cost would be included in operating. And, you know, that's just an example of the disconnect between the P&L and the statement of cash flows. I do not want to try and align them for the reasons that Nick and others specified. I think that will chew up too much time. But I'm wondering if we could help address the disconnect by specifying some disaggregation within the statement of cash flows under the investing cash flows category as currently defined, and if that would help at least as a temporary bridge. Just asking the staff to think about that. I'm not advocating at this point that we go in that direction. It's the only way I could think of to try and reduce that. Otherwise, no questions.
Thanks for that, Mary. Just thank you for that suggestion. And, you know, I'm quite confident that we can resolve the question or the issue around the naming because we had, you know, suggestions like you have made. We also have other possible feasible suggestions as a way to resolve it by changing perhaps naming in the statement of profit or loss rather than making further changes to the statement of cash flows, given that we are not doing comprehensive review of that statement. So between these different approaches, I think we will. I'm positive that we'll be able to find a solution to this. But yeah, let's see.
Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Just one comment on the cost of changing the starting point and the classification of interest and dividend cash flows. Some stakeholder raised, particular banks. I feel very interesting because some banks say that they think that it will incur additional costs, but without any expected benefit arising from our proposal. So I wonder whether we can do a little bit further work because, for example, starting point, as I know, many banks actually start from profit before taxation rather than operating profit at, based on the current practice. So in my understanding, if we change the starting point from profit before tax to operating profit, that means actually those adjustments those companies need to make actually will be reduced. So that means the cost should be reduced rather than will be added. So, and also whether those reduced adjustment item actually have some relevant information because we reduce something. Because some people say it will not, you know, provide useful information or something like that. So I think a little bit further cost and benefit analysis, particularly in relation to bank statement bank's cash flow statement, I think it will be helpful for us to get more understand more about their concerns about cost and benefit analysis. Thank you.
Thanks, Chow. If I can just maybe quickly come in, and because that also struck me as interesting, and in the field work we had companies, and I'll ask Nick, feel free to jump in if there's anything you like to add, given that you've been involved and run this much more. I don't think people disagreed. Ultimately, it's simple, like you said, you know, having operating as a starting point. There's few reconciling items, but they just said the fact that they had to change, you know, would mean lots of work for the system just because this reconciliation will look different. And it was that work, I think that initial work that they were referring to, that was my understanding, but we will make sure that in the paper that we prepare on re-deliberating this topic, we make sure that that is, you know, clear for discussion.
Okay, any other questions? No, then I suggest we move on.
So the next paper is kind of catch-all paper, which is the agenda paper 21C for this board meeting, which is on the other topics. And this is really, you know, the other question we had in the exposure draft, which was there to cover any topic on which we did not have a specific question for give stakeholders opportunity to comment. So we did not specifically ask fieldwork participants to do anything in relation to these other topics, nor did we have any academic literature review relating to these topics. So this is really what you see in this paper based on the comment letters and the bits we have heard during our outreach meetings. And, you know, there is a mix of topics here that are being discussed. So lots of feedback in this area relates to requests for additional projects. There's a whole list there. You have in paragraph 17, quite helpfully, many stakeholders have said they do not expect this to be done necessarily in the scope of PFS projects. So we have already shared this with agenda consultation team, for example. But we also had feedback on a number of consequential amendments the board has proposed in relation to interim reporting, earnings per share. We also have, if you recall, a very small proposal relating to other comprehensive income. And also we received feedback on the implementation period. And I also just want to note that the number of comments gave us very, very helpful suggestions in relation to illustrative examples and also some drafting comments. And we didn't comprehensively cover that in this paper, but we have created a summary for our internal use, which we will make sure to consider as we go through re-deliberation. So with that, I will just pause to see if you have any reactions to this other feedback and anything particular you want us to consider or elaborate on as we prepare re-deliberation papers on these topics.
Nick.
Thanks, Hans. If I just look at the items that are listed in paragraph 17 in terms of those topics there, I think with the exception of equity accounting, where the board already has a project underway, virtually all of those topics are captured one way or another in the work has been done through the agenda consultation and consulting with stakeholders to work up a list of projects to be described in that consultation. So it's good news that, as you highlighted earlier, you know, those are captured and there's an opportunity for stakeholders to express their views within the context of the agenda consultation on those issues.
Tadeu?
Thank you, Hans. It's just a quick comment here that one of the comments is in relation to the time for the implementation of the changes. Despite this is much more related to disclosure, this project, but it seems that for some information to be included, it may need some change in the system. And again, I think that the field work may help us very much to determine what would be a reasonable time for implementing the changes. But at the same time, if we go forward, and we probably will, but we need to decide it with early application, we also can meet some expectation that those that would like to do this before. And then I think that is a very valid feedback. Thank you.
Jianqiao, did you want to say anything on this topic, on this paper? Yes, go ahead.
Yes, Hans. Just one comment. I feel a little bit unclear about paragraph 9b. There are some respondents raised the issue about interim reporting, and they require the same structure for the primary financial statement in the interim reporting as in the annual financial statement. I think because the issue I feel a little bit unclear is that if those companies prepare their interim financial reporting and include a set of complete financial statement, which is exactly same as annual report, so should be no problem. If those companies prepare or include a set of condensed financial statement in their interim financial report, it could be maybe a problem, the issue arising. But and in according with IS 34, there is a requirement, those headings, those subtotals of those, you know, condensed financial statements should be same as those as in the annual financial statement. So I wonder whether the same structure they refer to is only limited to those subtotals and the headings, or also require those companies to, you know, disclose or present those minimum line item should also be same as those minimum line item included in the annual financial statement. So that is the issue. So I'm not clear whether what kind of issue they address try to improve the compatibility between interim financial reporting with annual financial statements.
Yes, you're quite right, Jianqiao, that, you know, I think looking at the wording here saying the same structure, well, essential structure is required to be the same per the ED, where you have to have, you know, you would have the same subtotals as required. But like you pointed out, the comment was really about all the other line items, which you are not required to present in interims if you're doing condensed financial statements, and many companies don't. So they would have something like total expenses line item, and then clearly that's not comparable with what is presented on an annual basis. So it was a comment in regards to that.
Okay, Mary?
Two things. I started out with one, but Jianqiao's comment about interims just leads me to the general suggestion that maybe what we have to do is clarify what consequences the interaction of the changes introduced by PFS and the existing requirements in IS 34 have. I, you know, much as I'd love to get my hands on IS 34 and think about whether there should be any changes made there, I think that that is beyond the scope of this project, and we should not get sucked into going down that path. But it may point to some question about what the interaction of these two are, and that's maybe something we have to think about whether or not any guidance is needed. I originally just wanted to comment on paragraph 20C. You noted a request for an exception from the new standard for some entities, for example, non-publicly accountable or investment funds, etc. As a general matter, I wanted to encourage caution about creating exemptions from the scope of our standards. It's something we do from time to time when there's a compelling reason, and you know, I think particularly of our earnings per share and our segment requirements. But on the whole, I think one of the great strengths of IFRS standards from a user of the financial statements, but also a user of the standards, is it's a single set that in general applies to everyone, and I would urge caution about undercutting that. So it's not absolutely off limits, but if you're going to follow up on that, think I I'd like a compelling reason to do something rather than a it would be nice or it would help.
Tom?
Yeah, just a very quick question slash comment on 20A, paragraph 20A. It talks about some people would like to see some deleted paragraphs, some IAS 1 reinstated. It doesn't really do much analysis. Are you guys planning to kind of just as part of the redeliberations, review those paragraphs and just confirm why we're taking them out or that we might put them back?
Yes, Tom, I expect we will need a paper on that, probably not in the early stages of redeliberation, but later on.
Mary, you want to come back in?
Yeah, just on the question that Tom asked, when I look at the items in 20A, they seem to be changes that were made not in the course of this project, but rather in previous projects. So prohibition of extraordinary items was something that was done a number of years ago. The different materiality for PFS in the notes or the possibility that there is, I imagine that that relates to the changes we made to the definition of materiality. So if these are requests to reconsider finalized decisions in other projects, I guess I question why we need to get a paper back on doing that. They would seem to be outside the scope of this project.
This is really from the drafting perspective, Mary. So it's not as in discussing extraordinary, but we proposed or the ED proposed to remove that paragraph prohibiting presentation of extraordinary because it was deemed redundant, given that the structure, new structure wouldn't allow it. But some stakeholders said it is still helpful to have a paragraph like that, for example. And then, like you mentioned, there was some paragraphs relating to materiality, which we removed and, you know, explaining in the basis that we didn't think that would change the outcome. It was just the drafting, but we had feedback on that. So I suspect some kind of discussion might be helpful just to make sure, you know, that this all works. So that's all.
Okay. Any other comments? No. All right, Aida, you can move on.
Okay, it's time for investor feedback. And Fred, thank you, Fred, for joining us to do this, and over to you.
Thank you, Aida. Thank you, Chair. Agenda Paper 21D analyzes the feedback that we had from user comment letters and our user outreach meetings on the proposals as set out in the exposure draft. I would very much like to thank all of the board members and the project team for the energy and enthusiasm that they brought to the investor outreach meetings, webinars, and other activities throughout the consultation period, especially in light of the pandemic. It was a great pleasure to do all those meetings with investors, and I think they came away with a very positive impression of the ED, not just for its contents, but I think how all of us presented the materials. I take the paper as having been read and will limit my tee up to just highlighting a couple of items. I think if we look at paragraph 18, it notes the strong support for defining operating profit that we saw in all of the comment letters from users. And I think it's worth mentioning just how positive it is to see this, given that it isn't always the case that you get this type of unanimous support from users when we do outreach on other projects. And then the other one I'd like to highlight is in paragraph 76, where we discuss management performance measures. Strong support there, again, from users. And to me, that sort of came as a very pleasant surprise. If we contrast that with the support that we heard for including management performance measures in financial statements during the deliberations period, it was maybe a bit more of a gray area. And I think we saw strong support there from users, probably reflecting the growth in usage of these measures by investors over that 3 or 4 year period. And really, that's something that has probably fueled a growing demand for the transparency and discipline that the proposals could provide. So I thank you again for the support on all the outreach activities, and we're ready to take questions or comments.
Anne? Thanks, Sue. Yeah, great paper, so interesting and such a great compliment to all the other papers. Three things that I'd like to mention. In the staff questions to the board, a lot of the questions are about things that we'd like to understand better, what we want to know more about. So three things. Firstly, it's to do with unusual items and EBITDA, which is paragraph 63, 64 of this paper. I'd like to know whether there's more agreement from this group than in other groups. Because when we looked at this in December, we could see there was a diversity of views on the matters of unusual items and EBITDA in board amongst board members, and the diversities around definition and presentation. I just would like to get a feel for whether the user group is more aligned within their group than the whole stakeholder community. That was my first thing. My second thing, I was wondering if staff could collate all the information they've got through the comment letters on digital, because this is all about presentation, but we think about it in a very paper-based way. And I think we need to think about it in from an XBRL perspective, so taxonomy tagging perspective, but also from the databases perspective in terms of how preparers input data via the taxonomy, of course, and how users extract data. So in terms of feedback, are we getting comments that can help us think more electronically about this project? And the third thing is, can you also somehow collect comments that are going to be relevant to the PIRs so that that can go on to the PIR teams? Because what I see as I read all the papers, there's things that come up that would be relevant to the PIR of 10, 11 and 12, because people are commenting on joint ventures and associates and reforming the equity method. They're also commenting on revenue when they talk about disaggregation. So I can see that feedback. And it's always important that we have the user feedback and we keep it in our system so that people don't get frustrated saying, we've already told you this, you know this already. They're my three points. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Anne. If I can just come maybe on a couple of these, and we will reserve the right to, you know, do a fuller analysis, of course, when it comes to individual topics and get a proper response. But I think in your question on user versus overall feedback on unusual and EBITDA, there was diversity of feedback there amongst users, as well as you can see in the papers. I think on unusual, unlike other stakeholders, we haven't seen many, although there were a few users that said this proposal is not needed. And I think diversity in the views from users was more between the two groups, that one was the users that wanted to see a broader range of items that they would label non-recurring, that clearly was not captured by our high threshold for unusual in the exposure draft. So they would like this to be much broader, and they would like to pick and choose, therefore, what they consider unusual from this broader disclosure, whereas, you know, there was the other group of users that were very much in support of the high threshold that the board has proposed, because they want to limit, they want to see companies being limited in what they can label as unusual, and they saw this as being important. But as I said, there wasn't many that were completely against this, but a few did say, look, if you do disaggregation right, there is really no need for specific separate proposal on unusual if you just emphasize that non-recurrence is one of the characteristics. And I think on EBITDA, there was similarly users, I think, very much came on board with what the board has proposed to do, that, yes, of course, we still have those, you know, big fans of EBITDA that still think the board should address this explicitly, and we will have to discuss this again. But there was also a good number of them saying, look, we understand what you have done. You know, we think, you know, that this kind of is pragmatic solution. It works as well. So that is really there. I mean, I take your point on the digital. We didn't have that huge amount of comments, but we had some, so we'll make sure that is collated. And I think it's great to give us this reminders about sharing with other projects, because it is a broad project. We get lots of comments, and I'm in regular discussion with other project teams, and I'll just make sure that this continues so the information doesn't kind of get stuck when it should be shared with them. And hopefully I have Neely and others to help me to do that, make sure this happens on a regular basis. But thank you.
Thank you. Rika?
Thank you, Sue. Same as Anne, it's important for us to consider evolution of digital reporting and data. So my question to the staff is whether we have already received the feedback from the data providers, data service companies collect and produce the data for the users. I really want to know how our proposed requirements are helpful and helpful for their providing the data and collecting the data for the user for users analysis. So I'm just wondering if you have any thought about that. I just want to make sure about it.
Thanks, Rika. Fred will jump in on this one.
Yes, we did not have one-on-one meetings with our colleagues at the data aggregator firms during the outreach period in 2020. However, late in 2019, we did have some meetings with contacts at data aggregators relating to some of the taxonomy work. And in those meetings, at least comments about the proposals to define subtotals and so on were fairly well received in the sense that it would make the work that they have to do more straight through processing and efficient, if you want to call it that. But also for the redeliberations plan, that's something where we can support the team with some outreach that targets contacts at data aggregators to close any loops that you think are worth closing in that area.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks.
That's really helpful.
Thanks. I think Rachel also had some more comments on this. Rachel.
Yes, just to add that as part of the work that the taxonomy team is doing on the PFS project, we're looking at early modelling of the proposals, and we've already had some discussions with our consultative group, the ITCG, in relation to how the proposals might be modelled. And that group includes data aggregators in the membership, so we are getting feedback through that process as well.
Okay, thank you.
Tadar? Thank you. So I think that first it was great work to get all this feedback from users. We know sometimes quite difficult to get comment letters from them, and then we have to work very hard on the outreach. And then I think that the team has done a very good job. It's a very comprehensive view. I have just one comment on paragraph 32 in relation to the option that we have for classifying the income and expenses other than when you are not able to make the segregation, and then you can classify everything within operating. And there was some critics in relation to this one. I would explore a bit more, trying to understand what would be the suggestion from the users, because in some cases, from the operational point of view, might be very difficult to make the segregation. That's why we have the option. But if there is anything that we could think about that, because we also do not like options because it difficulties the comparability. But in this case specifically, there is a reason for. But it would be good if we can get more details from the users to see what would be the suggestion, for example, in this case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mary. You're talking to yourself, Mary.
asked Nick to go first.
Yeah, she messaged me separately to say she's ready, but Mary, are you? I can't hear you, so we'll let Nick go first while you deal with your IT. Nick?
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, congratulations to both the project team and the investor engagement team. I think, as others have said, this has been a fantastic endeavour to get so much feedback. Just a couple of comments on the issue around structure that we have talked about. And first of all, the implications for going digital. I would say my own hands-on experience of using taxonomies is that having a consistent structure is absolutely fundamental to increasing the utility of digital data. It's transformational. And so I think this project actually moves us strongly in that direction. The second point on structure really is around, and it's unsurprising, and Fred highlights it very early on in the paper, that users have welcomed the proposals on having more structure for the P&L statement. I think it's also worth mentioning or remembering, although this paper doesn't seek to address this, is clearly in the absence of IFRS requirements, many jurisdictions have practically put in their own requirements around structure or practice has developed. And so implicitly in that, there is an understanding, acknowledgement that structure is important, and we shouldn't forget that acknowledgement. Now, clearly the challenge today is that over the last couple of decades, markets and capital markets have become more global in nature. Now, the request from users, the ask, is to have something that is applicable across all of our jurisdictions. But clearly, I think we have an implicit recognition from both preparers and from national standard setters and from others that structure clearly does help. We just need to find that route that is the optimum structure for all of our stakeholders. Thank you.
Good point. Mary, do you want to try again?
Working this time?
Yes.
Excellent. The wonders of reboot. Thank you. I wanted to start by echoing what Tadeo was saying about, expressing thanks and reinforcement for collecting these user views in two ways. One is the very focused and diligent effort on outreach, and second, summarizing the comments in a standalone paper, because while it is very helpful, and I appreciated having the user comments integrated on the topic by topic paper, I also find it important to be able to step back and get an overall sense of the user comments about the shape and viability of the project. And I think doing that on a standalone basis is quite important. So both congratulations and thanks for that. I think it's a very important stage aspect of this project. And then the second thing I was going to comment on is in the areas of paragraph 63 to 67, which is about unusual items. And it appears to me that there's a similar kind of mix of views about unusual items in the way forward, as we saw from other stakeholder groups. I think everybody would like us to be successful in this area, but people have quite different views about what success would be, and they're quite mixed. I think for redeliberations, my suggestion is make sure that we extract from the feedback we've had what users' objectives are in this area, rather than focusing only on their reaction to the specific proposals that we had, because I think we have to think widely about how we can move forward to satisfy what those objectives are and how they want to use the information as our first goal, given the mix and at times quite conflicting views that we have in this area of unusual items about how to achieve that outcome. So that's in terms of redeliberation, make sure we pull out good articulations of what people want to do with this information, how they're using it, what they want us to try and achieve. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary. Zach?
Thanks. Again, thank you to the staff. Thank first for putting all this together, and second for getting all of us involved in these discussions. I thought it was extraordinarily useful. I wanted to comment on the unusual items specifically, where what I really saw in the feedback I was hearing, particularly the live feedback, was two clusters of feedback. One that viewed unusual items as a very broad category that should capture as much as possible, and the second having been a very narrow definition of unusual items. So where we see mixed, I think it's important to consider those types of dynamics. I think the feedback that I heard was that users were strongly supportive of the idea of unusual items. They just had different definitions of what it was. And as we go forward, I would challenge the staff to think about and present to us different ways that the management performance measures and the unusual items can interact, and what the relationship between those might be. Because I have a feeling some of those that commented with the broader definition would be fully satisfied with the management performance measures if those were expanded as well.
Thanks, Zach. Can I hand back to staff?
Thank you, Sue. And I want to welcome Anna and thank her for joining us again and give us an overview of the work on the academic and other literature review. Over to you, Anna.
Thank you, Aida, and good morning. I'm now going to present a brief overview of the academic literature, and I will present briefly summary to the questions in the exposure draft, summary of the literature to each of the questions in the exposure draft where I could identify relevant papers. And these papers were located from academic databases, or we identified them in staff's academic outreach workshops and also in received comment letters. So firstly, related to question one, academic research has shown that users of financial statements view operating profit as a useful measure of performance, and to the extent that it enhances comparability, the inclusion of operating profit as a subtotal in the statement of profit or loss is likely to benefit investors, analysts, auditors, and the reporting entities. Related to questions two to question five in the exposure draft, the academic literature that we identified focuses mainly on the operating and financing categories. There is evidence that distinguishing between operating and financing activities is useful for investors, and it also corresponds to a conceptual distinction between an entity's value generation and value distribution activities. The evidence on earnings before interest and tax, EBIT, which is the closest equivalent to the proposed profit or loss before financing and income tax that I could identify papers for, is that EBIT is one of the most frequently disclosed measures by entities, and it features prominently in entities' press releases. On the proposed distinction between integral and non-integral associates in question seven, there is some evidence that investors differentiate between investments based on the level of the expected synergies. And there is also some evidence from one study that entities regard associate income as closer to operating income than investment income. Related to the disaggregation proposals in question eight of the exposure draft, the literature concludes that more disaggregation increases the informativeness of financial statements and also the reliability of the resulting subtotals. And managers' disaggregation choices become less opportunistic when managers face pressures to report transparently. This is the result of some experimental evidence. in relation to question 9, the evidence is that there is wide variation in the methods used by entities, and entities' choices between function and nature are mainly driven by country, industry, auditor type, and degree of an entity's international exposure. On question 10, the evidence shows that special or unusual items have an important role for forecasting. Managers sometimes misclassify these items, and the evidence on whether investors can see through such misclassification is mixed. On the proposals on management performance measures, the research has shown that they are associated with stock prices and stock returns, implying that they are value relevant. And managers disclose non-GAAP measures to better convey the performance of their entities, but also sometimes for opportunistic reasons. The content of non-GAAP measures varies widely across entities, and the academic literature shows that transparency, consistency, and full reconciliation to the closest GAAP equivalent are key for their decision usefulness. The evidence on EBITDA is that it is widely used, and some studies show that because of its widespread use, entities might focus on it unduly, and therefore the literature has shown that EBITDA disclosures tend to be more opportunistic than other non-GAAP disclosures. And finally, related to question 13, the academic evidence shows that the existing flexibility in the cash flow statement allows managers to make strategic classification choices, which may adversely impact financial statements comparability. So this is my summary, and does the board have any questions or comments in relation to this paper?
I am back, so I can take over from Sue again. Nick, was the order that was the, Nick, please.
Yeah, thanks, Hans. So Anna, thank you very much for all your hard work here. I think it's reassuring that many of the conclusions that you draw or reflect upon from your review are aligned with our proposals and our thinking here. The one area that probably surprised me is there's a study around the extent to which I think it's mainly European firms are reporting either by function or by nature or a mix of those two. That's on page 14 of your paper. And to me, that doesn't seem to be aligned with our own experience, with our own sampling work. That insofar as it suggests that, you know, many more companies are already reporting by nature, and very few are reporting a mixture of by function and by nature. I don't know, Anna, if it's for you or Aida, just to comment on whether we think that is reflective of our broader experience. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. I mean, this is European study, so there is clearly much more by nature reporting than when you look at perhaps global sample and some jurisdictions that have more by function reporting, if I'm not mistaken. I think, for example, Japan is one of those. Is that right, Rika? So some South American countries. So I think when you compare global sample versus European sample, it's inevitable that you get different different outcomes, but yeah, it did. So therefore, it didn't surprise me as much to find this. But yeah, I don't know if anybody else wishes to comment on that.
I mean, especially, I mean, just I'm stunned by the extraordinarily low numbers of mixed by function by nature in the study.
I think that's the one that you need to take with pinch of salt, perhaps. And I think talking to some of the academics in our doing research on the project, it became clear that what they consider mixed is not perhaps the same that we consider as mixed. So I think that that's the bit that really depends on their interpretation. And I'm not sure if the paper itself explains their definition of mixed. It's quite possible that some of those B15 famous line items may not have been considered as mixed, which is what we considered as mixed, and so on.
Genchao. Oh, Nick, yeah?
No, I'm all done.
Genchao?
Thank you, Hans. As Nick said, I also appreciate the paper. It's a very good paper. I think there's huge, huge work behind this paper, because when I read the reference, there are more than 120 papers included, was included in this one single paper. So at least you need to read and summarize all those findings. It's very useful. I just have two comments. One is about the comments comments on section two, that is question two to five, relating to the operating category and the investing category. The academic literature find that those papers actually focus on the operating and the financing distinction. So my question is that, because I would like to see where the income and expenses arising from those investing activities go to, you know, when they do this research, because currently they only make the distinction between operating and financing. So where is the investing, you know, income, whether those, when they do research, whether those investing, their investment income go to operating income or simply just exclude those investment income, you know, from operating or financing, you know, activities, and just leave it alone when they do this research. So this is the first question, where are those investment income and expenses? Second question is about integral, non-integral associate and joint venture. I think the academic research show that investors actually, they are trying to differentiate between integral and non-integral based on the level of expected synergies. So I think how to assess and make a judgment of those expected synergies is very important to distinguish those integral or non-integral, or whether what kind of mean, you know, name they used. So I'm wondering, because I didn't dig into the looking at those papers, but I wonder what kind of you know, criteria they use to make assessment. The level of expected synergies would be very useful for us to look at those details if we are going to make a distinction between integral and non-integral associates or joint ventures. So if there are any, you know, detailed message or information would be very helpful for us. And whether those level of expected synergies is similar as the criteria or guidance we introduced in our exposure draft.
Thank you, Genchao. So in relation to the first question on investment income, first, the reason investment income is not included here is because I could not find evidence of papers referring to it in the context of income statement presentation or disaggregation. And to your question specifically, I think some of these studies talk about distinguishing between operating and financing activities conceptually. They're not all of them are empirical. And also the empirical studies that look at operating and financing income, they don't necessarily and don't always look at the income statement in its entirety. In other words, include all the categories of the income statement, but they would, for example, may focus on whether the company reports operating profit, and therefore they make they have that category on the income statement, or whether they report the financing activities separately. And that's why there isn't based on these papers, I'm not able to answer your question, what did they do and how do they present investment income? Because if they're focusing on operating, they would look just for that subtotal rather than have... with regard to your second question, integral versus non-integral, yes, the literature that is included here, I identified it as the one with most relevant, but I wouldn't say is directly and very relevant to the proposal in the exposure draft. And those papers that look at such expected synergies, they would have one variable, for example, an indicator variable, if those expected synergies are mentioned somewhere in the financial statements. There are various, it's based on these two papers, but I wouldn't say they correspond to the criteria. As I mentioned, these papers are finance papers, and they look at mergers and acquisitions and try to explain what distinguishes successful versus investments in associates and what distinguishes successful versus not so successful. So I wouldn't say there is full correspondence with the criteria in the exposure draft.
Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. It's just one of the conclusions on the aggregation and disaggregation that actually sounds like that companies in a weaker position, they would like to disaggregate. And then for me, it was actually a surprise that those that are stronger would like to aggregate because they would get rid of those points that are negative. But the main point here that you can get is that I think that the project was in the right direction, determining the principles of aggregation, disaggregation, because I personally believe that in some cases, management wants to aggregate or disaggregate in a opportunistically, not necessarily they are weaker or stronger position, but actually because some items, individual items might, they want not need to explain or because they don't want these to affect the future prospects, the projections. I think that the way that you have done in the project, trying to define what are the principles of aggregation and segregation, would have a more comprehensive impact than just going in the direction of having more or less disaggregation. I think that the principles are more important. Thank you.
Okay. I believe that ends our discussion on this particular paper. So Aida, are we now ready to talk about the plan for re-deliberations?
We are ready. Are you ready? So agenda paper 21A, plan for re-deliberations. So what we have here is a number of questions on number of bullets, was to say. We have a few lists for you, and I will try to kind of make a sense out of that. So how we approached and planning for re-deliberations. So what the team thought about, we said, okay, let's first say what are the factors that are relevant for us when we just think about re-deliberations and how to approach re-deliberations. So we have a discussion about those factors. And then considering those factors, we said, okay, what should our general approach then be like? And then finally, what should therefore our approach be on each of the project topics? And then at the end, we have a bit of discussion on project timing, but as you have seen, it's not very conclusive given that we have still a number of decisions on scope to be made. So talking about factors that are relevant, we identify four such factors. The first one is the project objective and its focus. Then linkages, considering linkages between project topics. Then timeliness being important factor. And finally, just efficient use of resources of staff and the board. So taking into account these factors we identify, and we are seeking feedback if you think there are any other factors that you think we should consider. we have then considered general approach. In other words, which project topics we thought would require staged approach to re-deliberation, which project topics should be prioritized, and which project topics should be removed or added to the project scope. So taking each of these in turn, in regards to staged approach to re-deliberation, in other words, what this means, where we will first ask the board to confirm the overall objectives, look at feasibility of alternative approaches, and confirm general direction before we proceed to prepare any papers on the detailed approach. So we identified four project areas or topics that fall here. One is the minimum line item. The other one is proposals relating to integral and non-integral associate and joint ventures, then proposals for unusual income and expenses, and proposals relating to analysis of expenses by nature and by function. So these are the staged approach topics we are planning. Then when we looked at, and with staged approach, we also have a mini staged approach in discussion for management performance measures when considering whether to potentially expand the scope beyond income and expense subtotals. For other topics, we plan that initial papers on these topics will cover also some of the detailed discussion as well as confirm overall approach. Now looking at the priorities, or in other words, which topics we should discuss first, we identified subtotals and categories as a priority, being in the heart of the project. Also management performance measures, proposals relating to roles of primary financial statements and the notes and principles of disaggregation, and finally proposals relating to the statement of cash flows. And there are a little bit different reasons behind why each of these is a priority, which is discussed in the paper. And then a final point on this general approach is looking at which projects could be which topics could be added or removed to the project scope. We are not making any specific suggestions here, but there is a number of decisions for the board to make in regards to project scope in relation to each of these topics that I mentioned requires staged approach, because this staged approach in itself makes it possible that the board decides, you know, not to make any changes or go in a different direction, which might then therefore involve change in the scope. So this is general approach. And then when we look at approach by individual topics, in the paper we discuss what we are planning to cover in the initial papers on each of these topics, and then what are the remaining topics in subsequent papers. I'm not going to go through these lists in the tee-up, but I just want to mention a couple of assumptions we are planning to make, and it will be very useful for us to get your feedback on these assumptions. So first, in relation to papers on subtotals and categories, we are planning to make two assumptions. One is that the board will proceed with defining and requiring entities to present operating profit subtotals. And second one is the board will proceed with defining operating category, with defining operating category as a default category. So I'm saying these are assumptions. This is not to say we are not going to ask the board to confirm these decisions, but this, by making this assumption now, we are saying that we will try in these initial papers also to go beyond these questions that already have some of the more detailed discussions, because we assume the board will agree with these questions. So if you think you will not agree and we need more discussion on that before proceeding, that will be very useful to know. And then also we're planning to make assumption in relation to management performance measures, in that the board, we assuming the board will proceed with the proposals for management performance measures, and therefore in that same initial paper we are also planning to have some discussion about feasibility of potential widened scope beyond income and expense subtotals. So that is a kind of a summary of approach to individual topics. We are not making any more assumptions. The rest of the discussion is really listing the things we're going to mention in initial papers and subsequent papers. And then finally, as I mentioned, the paper, we had a bit of discussion on project timing, saying that this is really something that we are in better position to make an estimate later on once the board has made initial decisions on these topics that are in the staged approach. So now over for you for discussion. We have a question, which is generally, do you agree with the proposed plan for the deliberations? And then specifically, we are asking for comments and suggestions in relation to factors to consider in approaching redeliberations, our proposed general approach to redeliberations, and our approach to proposed approach to redeliberations by individual project topics.
Okay, thank you, Aida. Sue.
Thanks, Hans. I had a couple of general comments and then a couple of specific ones. So firstly, the general one. Firstly, thank you for the paper. I think it's very good from a project management perspective, but also a signalling perspective to the market in terms of what to expect for the roadmap going forward, to have this structured thinking about how we best, you know, start the redeliberation. So well done for thinking it through and bringing it to us to comment on. In terms of the assumptions that you mentioned, so particularly the one about the operating profit subtotal and that being a residual in the management performance measures, I agree with you in terms of having a sort of starting assumption that sort of frames the way that you bring the papers to us. I think we need to be careful with our communication that that doesn't mean that people hear us say, you know, that's already a given and it's not going to be voted on. You added the caveat, but I think we're just going to have to be careful to make sure that's clear to people in the communication, that it will be analysed in the paper. But that's sort of how you're framing the papers, I think, is what you mean, which I think is a sensible idea. I touched base with you before the meeting, just in a couple of places where we, I think one was nature versus function. We talk about, you know, the feedback we got, and that we'll have a paper that looks at, you know, how we develop the proposals. And I just said to you in a couple of topics, including that one, does that include sort of doing nothing as an option? You confirmed that that was the case. I'm not saying it should be the answer, but I think in some cases we'll need to make maybe some tough decisions in terms of how much time do we spend, you know, solving a number of different issues to make the perfect product, versus how much time do we spend making something that's still a really good improvement that focuses on the fundamental improvements to get it done, particularly because investors, I think, are keen to see these changes, you know, in the not too distant future. And you confirmed to me that despite the wording in the paper, the plan would be in those cases to have that as one of the options, to not adjust what we've got in our requirements today, if on a sort of balanced basis that might be the best approach in a couple of places. So thank you.
Okay, Françoise.
Thank you, and thank you to the team for the paper and the redeliberation plan. I support what you propose, both generically and in detail. And I'm really impressed by how this paper reflects how well digested the feedback we've received is. And also, I particularly support the strategic approach you have to deliberations and framing an objective of being timely in bringing a much needed and awaited improvement. So well done, in my view, and support.
Thank you, Françoise. Rika.
Thank you. Thank you for staff to prepare a very good paper about our deliberation plan. I support staff's general approach to use staged approach and the mini staged approach, especially about I really think it's critical for us to confirm the overall objectives to ensure the basic and the principal foundation of the our proposed scope and as well as the proposed requirements. And also I agree with placing a certain assumption for a future detailed discussion point. But having said that, I would like to have two requests to the staff in connection with the subtotals and categories requirements. I have observed some practice of the existing IS1 requirement that the key performance measures on the face support the effective communication between companies and the investors rather than those disclosed in the footnote. So therefore, I would like to ask the staff to work on the 2 points in the future in terms of the agenda paper that we will first discuss the definition of the operating income. I really like to ask the staff to add some analysis of the benefit from more consistent subtotals, including the operating income defined by the ISB, especially how effectively could those subtotals help investors' understanding of the company's performance, even though subtotals or any other measures presented on the face not aligned with the key measure used for management purpose of the company. So I think it's really helpful if you could include and demonstrate the benefit of consistent subtotals defined by the ISB compared with the, the benefit of those subtotals defined of, by management in the current practice. And another thing is a little bit wider consideration to support the transition and implementation of this new standard. So I don't think we need an immediate response, but it would be very helpful for staff and us to consider how we can support the practice to initially implement the new requirement of subtotals and category as well as other part of this new standard, especially some companies that really enjoy effective and efficient communication with investor by using the existing requirement. But that is also a benefit for all stakeholders because I think the impact of the changes, especially structural changes caused by this standard, will be substantive and pervasive in terms of the management communication with all stakeholders internally and externally. So I would like to see further discussion in the future about that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rika. Nick.
Thanks, Hans. I just wanted to go back to paragraph 11 and the factors to consider when thinking about deliberation. I think these are the right factors. But clearly there's an interplay between the connectivity or the linkages between the project topics and timeliness and efficiency, and particularly wishing to avoid, I guess, endless iteration or coming back to the board because we've had another development and another discussion. And I think it might just be worth for staff, I'm not suggesting you have to bring this to board, but just as a way of thinking of those decisions which are really independent of other decisions. And a very simple example would be around EBITDA, our definition of, not EBITDA, but our definition anyway, and do we include impairment or not in that? It's a straightforward decision. It doesn't depend, I don't think, on really anything else in the project. But then separately to think about the degree of connectivity in those other decisions, and really where to identify those separately and to think, and again, I'm not saying whether they should come early or late, but to think whether highly dependent decisions, where they are best placed to come in the re-deliberation plan. Is there a scope to bring some of those early or do some of them have to come late by nature? But just really to try and get a grip of those that high degree of dependent decisions and how we manage those. I think that's going to be a key factor here. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I also support the staff's, I support the paper that the factors we need to consider and the staged approach. Particularly, I think it's very good and very clear roadmap to guide the project to move forward. I also support that two assumptions in relation to the operating category. But I have two questions. First, about main business activities. It's not very clear to me because the paper did mention main business activities and provide additional guidance, but in the context of classify some investing activities or financing activities if they meet, you know, for example, investing in the course of main businesses or the company's main business is provide financing to customers, maybe they will need to be classified as operating category rather than other category. My question is that where and when we are going to generate to address, maybe to define or clarify the term or terminology of main business activities first. For example, whether it will be addressed in the context of defining operating activities first, and then to look at other activities, whether they fit into that that category or that definition, or whether we are going to address main business activities later. So this is the first question. Second is about the minimum line item. We are going to do a comprehensive review of minimum ally items, whether we are going to do. And the question is about what's the meaning of the comprehensive review of minimum ally items, whether we are going to specifically only review those minimum ally items included in IS1, or propose the final statement, or whether we are going to address those minimum ally items which were proposed or defined in other IFI standards. We are also to double check, look at those ally items which were defined or proposed in other IFI standards.
Thank you, Jinchao. You are in good form today. I'm answering lots of your questions, but thank you for looking at this and considering. I just want to comment on main business activities, because that is something we actually debated internally, because like you said, there are two ways we could have approached discussion around how would a proposal supply to entities with specific main business activities, which could either tackle it together when we discuss, you know, what is in the operating, what is in the investing and financing, or we could do it like we have done it in the run-up for the ED and have a separate discussion. So we consider this approach of discussing it together, but at the end we decided, because there are so many specific considerations for these entities and their circumstances, this would make those papers incredibly complex, and tackling this on its own is already complex enough. So we are proposing similar approach to what we had in the run-up to the ED. So we would have, so you can see in paragraph 30B, 30C is the paper that would deal with main business activities, and that would also include discussion of whether any additional guidance could or should be provided in relation to the meaning of the main business activities. So that is on your first question. Your second question, I think it's a good question on, you know, what could this involve, and that's exactly why we propose staged approach for minimum line items to first confirm overall where does the board, what does it wants us to review before we prepare papers on review. I don't think there is a huge difference between looking at what is in IS1 only versus other standards. I think we identified only one item, maybe that is one or two, was it, that is not in IS1, that is mentioned that the minimum line item is another standards. In other cases, it's all been carried into IS1, so that is not an issue. But there are a number of other things and suggestions that were made that, you know, we would like to explore with the board before we go into the detailed discussion of what specific proposals would be on minimum line items. So,
okay, M.
Thanks, Hans. I agree with the objectives listed in paragraph 11, but the one I want to comment on is timeliness. So I think we have a big challenge here with timeliness, because on the one hand, we've got people that are very keen to see a standard and have it in use. And on the other hand, we've got such a range of topics and so much information. There's just so much work we could do. So I think the real challenge is deciding where the time will be spent. You know, what are the priority areas? I think Aida today has said about the heart of the project. So starting in the heart and working outwards. It's not a linear list of projects and topics. They're interrelated, as Nick has rightly pointed out. So I think that as we think about timeliness, we have to know what the priority areas are. And as we go outward, we get more into other areas. And I think we've got some hard decisions about where we need to focus and the things we need to resolve and act on and the things that we're going to have to let go. And I know that's going to be hard, but I think looking at the project objective will help us do that. Thank you.
Tom?
Yeah, so very good job. I support the approach as outlined, and I'm looking forward to the more specific papers. I like Nick's caution to consider interrelated items early. I did have one specific comment on one paragraph that I wanted to perhaps share at this point, because it does speak to direction. In paragraph 34A4, it says, whether additional guidance may be required to help entities identify any measures that would be excluded from the definition because they do not complement subtotals required in IFRS standards. And I thought back to how the word complement got into the whole discussion. And way back at the beginning, we had a debate about substitute. Are MPM substitutes or are they complements? And we had this extended discussion. And we ultimately concluded that they were not substitutes. And therefore, we essentially said they must be complements, under the presumption that they're neither totally irrelevant nor completely misleading. And in that paragraph, it's gone from this, what are they in our minds, to a necessary condition. And I'm not sure that we really wanted it to be a necessary condition. So that's one of my cautions. I think you should think carefully about that. The discussion at the time, we basically said IFRS subtotals are the primary performance measures. MPMs are not substitutes for these. They are complements for these. And we thought it was really important to make this clear. And I think that's where it worked its way into a whole series of papers, that we were constantly making this clear, but not making it a necessary condition. And I think with respect to whether it needs to be a necessary condition, I was sort of looking at some other paragraphs. In other words, if we don't make it a necessary condition, are we at risk of items that are totally irrelevant or completely misleading can work their way into the notes? And I think there's enough protections. I think in particular, 103C, where we talk it has to be an aspect of performance, 105A, it must faithfully represent, and 106A2, the management has to tell you how it provides useful information. So all those things are going to act to keep out something that's totally irrelevant. And so I just noticed that one, because a lot of people did mention that, how would I apply it? And so I kind of urge you to think carefully about how we use this term complement, and perhaps removing or altering the wording so it doesn't come across as a necessary condition that may appear nebulous to readers.
Thank you, Tom. Bruce.
Thanks very much, Hans. Just to say to the staff, great paper. I mean, I'm fully supportive of this. The comment I wanted to make, so I'm not going to labor, which was the same one that mixed between what Anne and Nick had said. Just my concern around what Anne was saying, that timeliness is so vital. But I think we need to be conscious that there's a lot of interest in the project. And I just think when we're doing those linkages, just be careful we don't start waiting for other decisions or letting those things derail the process we've got here. Otherwise, I think we're going to end up taking a lot of things here that could derail that process. The other thing I was going to say is, I think what's very important to me in this approach is that there are so many moving parts in this project. We need to ensure that you guys have that foundation of those assumptions you can make as you're moving along. Because I think the danger becomes that if we don't get those, what I call those kind of foundational based assumptions done right, there can be a whole lot of work being done at a tangent where you know, there's something you thought was there, it hasn't been assumed, and then suddenly we end up having to relook at it. So yes, I think it's just that it's tough to ask for you guys, but just making sure that we're looking at it holistically as well as, of course, those moving parts.
Mary?
Thanks, Hans. I wanted to go back to something Tom was saying in paragraph 34, and I apologize if this is belated, as in I should have said it in December when we were discussing the MPM paper, but 34A2 and A3 talk about the proposed requirement that for when you, what you must assert about the management performance measure, and this is Tom's comment about necessary condition that really made me want to build on his comment about what you bring back for redeliberation. I think we should think about whether the requirement should be because you feel it's necessary to communicate performance, and whether it should be slightly more open in terms of a requirement to disclose why you are presenting that management performance measure. I think that that kind of nuance of it might help with item 34A3, you know, the risk that we've unintentionally excluded certain industry features. If you are, let's say, in a situation in which you think you don't particularly believe that that's a good measure for your entity, but you want to be comparable, so therefore you want to include it, you know, might help with that. So it's a specific suggestion when we get to MPMs to think about what our objective was when we set out the requirement to, I hereby swear that this MPM is X, to think about what we're trying to achieve and whether we have, as Tom was saying, sufficient safeguards elsewhere that we can, it can maybe think about softening that language slightly. Thank you.
Okay, are there any other comments to be made? I don't think so. So I believe that means we have come to the end of our deliberations for today and for this month. Thank you all. Thank the staff. Aida, is there something you would still like to say?
No, just to thank you again and ask, does this mean we have unanimous votes on agreement? I presume it does. I haven't heard Martin, though. I don't know. I can't see what Martin... Oh, Martin is thumbs up. Okay, great.
All right.
So thank you very much. You
very good discussion. Thank you. Bye-bye.